The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is a story about one man's journey from death row executioner to Lutheran pastor. It's titled The Executioner's Redemption, My Story of Violence, Death, and Saving Grace. You can check it out at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Executioner's Redemption is on sale for $12.99. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, The Executioner's Redemption.
Now, I don't know if the audience here knows it. I don't see any TVs here, but it has been projected by, I think, all of the networks that we won in Wisconsin.
God bless the great state of Wisconsin.
Well, there are the two winners of yesterday's Wisconsin primary, Senators Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz. Not just wins, but really big wins. Ted Cruz was 13 points ahead of Donald Trump in Wisconsin, and Sanders was 14 points ahead of Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin with almost 60% of the vote there. How do you explain that? And what does it mean in the long run, in the run for the White House? Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Mark and Molly Hemingway join us from the Weekly Standard and the Federalist for our weekly update on the November elections. Then, a little bit later, Dr. Frank Beckwith will be our guest. We're going to talk about possible punishment for abortionists and their customers and Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's recent statement on the rights of unborn persons. Joining us for our update on the November elections, as they do every week, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, glad to be back.
And Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, welcome.
It's great to be here with you.
Mark, you first. How do you explain double-digit wins by both Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz in Wisconsin yesterday?
Well, I think as far as Cruz is concerned, there are a couple of things. One is simply that Donald Trump has had a bad couple of weeks. He for a long time was able to say and do outrageous things and seemingly get away with it. I think a number of these episodes where he said things that alienated the pro-life community in the Republican Party, as well as the scandal involving his campaign manager and his grabbing of a political reporter, and a number of his tweeting out about these disparaging things about Ted Cruz's wife. I think that it was just a lot of bad things that, you know, that could no longer be sort of, you know, written away. And I think the media turned on him, and he got a lot of bad publicity. And if you see in the national polls, his movement has stalled nationally. And so that was reflected in Wisconsin, certainly. And I think the other thing is simply that, Wisconsin is Wisconsin. I mean, there are parts of this country that are culturally different. And there is, I think, such a thing as, you know, Midwestern nice. And what plays well in Brooklyn and the Bronx, you know, to be the brash, you know, striver, you know, billionaire guy, does not play well in a place where being, you know, nice and considerate and, you know, hard work are valued more than ostentatious displays of success. And I think just culturally, he is not made for Wisconsin.
Molly, what are your thoughts?
I think Wisconsin is a unique state, and I think that the voters there have had a lot of political battles in recent years that gave them practice at withstanding what the media wants them to accept or what elites want them to accept in terms of their battles with the union and various other shenanigans that have gone on there. So I think that did help Ted Cruz and hurt Donald Trump. And as far as Bernie Sanders goes, I think it's that, you know, everybody knows they're supposed to line up behind Hillary Clinton, that she's the more electable person, that she represents the broadest coalition, but she is just doing a tremendously bad job of sealing the deal. I saw that her campaign said that Bernie Sanders, if he didn't win New York, that he would be out of it, which I think shows that they realize he's still in it, even if he has a much more uphill battle than she does. But Wisconsin voters also not keen on, you know, a scandal-plagued, weak candidate who's selling the same old stuff on the Democratic side.
On the GOP side, Mark, of course, the Sanders-Clinton race, a two-person race there.
Right.
So Sanders gets 60%. That's extremely impressive, if you ask me. Cruz gets 48%, but then there's John Kasich. And if he were to drop out of the race, where do his voters go on the GOP side?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that his voters, you know, given the two choices, would probably fall more in line with Cruz, just because I think a lot of people are supporting Kasich because they think that he's temperamentally sane. And I don't think a lot of Kasich voters who are more moderate in that regard would like their choices between Cruz and Trump, but I think they would see Cruz as the sort of lesser of evils. But I don't think at this point in time, if Kasich has hung on this far, that he's going to drop out. To be charitable to Kasich, I've actually seen some compelling analysis that Kasich could actually end up hurting Trump's ability to get delegates in New Jersey and some other primaries that are coming up. But at the same time, I mean, I really think that Kasich is, you know, hoping to march into the convention with enough delegates that he can make some sort of compelling case, particularly since the likelihood of a contested convention is looking pretty high right now, that, you know, he's the guy that everybody can rally around on maybe the third or fourth ballot at a contested convention.
So everybody's learned what contested convention means in the last month and a half, Molly. The other question is third party run with respect to Donald Trump if he's denied the nomination in a contested convention. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I don't know if I love the language denied the nomination. The job of the candidates right now are to secure the nomination, and many people will not have made it. And it's looking like the greatest possibility is for a brokered convention. But that's just the natural part of the process of how the Republican Party figures out its nominee. And already frontrunners get so many advantages that other people don't get. And the establishment created those largely to help out moderate candidates who win in blue states. And what's, of course, funny is that Donald Trump he appeals much more to moderates than to conservatives in the Republican Party. So he's gaining all these advantages that the establishment in the Republican Party put forth to squash conservative candidates. And now they're probably wishing they hadn't done it. But yes, should he be able to actually come out of the convention with the nomination, I think that, you know, that would be huge. I don't think it's probable at this point, but he could certainly still manage it. And then you will see absolutely people seeking out alternatives just because of how unacceptable many constitutionalists or pro-lifers or people who care about religious liberty and the like might find Donald Trump. He could quell a third-party bid by picking as a vice presidential running mate someone who could really make conservatives feel more comfortable with a Republican nomination. And I think that while everybody assumes that Hillary Clinton would trounce Donald Trump in a general, and she certainly appears to be doing that in polls, I think that if he were to somehow pivot his campaign into being less insane and less histrionic and less whiny and less just bizarre like it has been in recent weeks, I think he actually could do much better than those polls indicate.
Mark, what are the odds that Donald Trump comes out of the convention as the party nominee?
I don't honestly think they're very high, and that's just because of, well, you have to look at it this way. Just because Trump has the most delegates does not mean that he is the guy that is uniting the party. And then the convention process is designed to produce somebody that unites the party. Now, if you come into convention with a majority of delegates, sure, yeah, you're obviously uniting the party. But thus far, Trump has had a hard ceiling of about 35% or so of the popular vote. And what that means is that the majority of people that have turned out to vote in the Republican primaries have actually voted against Trump. So the idea that he'd come in with the most votes, he's still at a plurality. That doesn't mean that he's going to be a figure that people can necessarily unite around. And for that reason, if you look at contested Republican conventions, I believe five of the last seven Republican contested conventions, the guy that had the plurality of votes coming to the convention did not end up being the nominee. And the convention process is designed to find somebody you can unify around. Dwight Eisenhower didn't have the plurality of delegates coming into the contested convention. And would anybody say that he was not a uniting figure for the Republican Party? I don't think anybody would say that.
Sorry, so, I wanted to make a quick point on this also with the delegates is that there are advantages given to whoever wins a plurality of votes in a certain state, and sometimes it's quite dramatic where the person who gets the most votes can actually get all of the delegates in a state, and they might be bound to that candidate on the first vote at convention, but on subsequent votes they won't be. And so let's say you're Donald Trump and you got 35% of the vote in a state and you took all of their delegates, but really 65% of those delegates don't like you, they just have to vote for you on that first ballot. well, they're not going to stick with you on the second ballot. And I think that's why Donald Trump's best chance is to lock it up before the convention or get it on that first ballot somehow. There can be some shenanigans on the first ballot. And if he doesn't do that, I think he starts really cratering after that.
Molly Hemingway is senior editor for The Federalist. Along with her, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for The Weekly Standard, are our guests for getting our weekly update on the November elections. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is a story about one man's journey from death row executioner to Lutheran pastor. It's titled The Executioner's Redemption, My Story of Violence, Death, and Saving Grace. You can check it out at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Executioner's Redemption is on sale for $12.99. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, The Executioner's Redemption.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The saints at Gethsemane Evangelical Lutheran Church in downtown Marion, Ohio, invite you to join us as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation, which he won for us in his perfect life, death, and resurrection. Sunday school for all ages begins at 9:15 a.m. with a divine service following at 10:30. Visit our website, gethsemane-lcms.org, or find us on Facebook to learn more about our confessional, historical, and liturgical congregation.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're getting an update on the vote in November elections with Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard and Molly Hemingway of the Federalist. Molly, here's another subject I wanted you to chime in on. Again, we've talked about it before. This is an AP story out of Jefferson City, Missouri, talking about the GOP's social and fiscal conservatives at odds over gay rights. Now, there is obviously a clash between social conservatives and their values and big business. The latest example, the governor of Mississippi, Phil Bryant, just yesterday signed into law a religious liberty law over against the objections of major corporations. What's happening here?
Well, you know, traditionally the Republican Party, as Reagan put it, is a three-legged stool. You have the leg that cares a great deal about national security, and that can mean different things for different people. You have the leg that cares about economic conservatism, and that too can mean different things. And then you have the sort of social conservative side, which might care about religious liberty or opposition to abortion or things of that nature. And you are seeing, and you have seen for quite a few years, some tension between those legs or attempts by one leg to take more power. The economic conservatives should have no conflict with social conservatives, and in fact, social conservatives tend to be quite economically conservative and in support of the market and allowing people to make economic decisions without too much government interference. In fact, it's the best way to ensure it is by being socially conservative. But there is also this aspect of that leg that's very much better described as corporate or crony. These are people who use the government in order to advantage themselves or their families, their businesses. And that is not at heart conservative, although it has a home both in the Republican Party and Democratic Party. And what you're seeing in our culture is this massive push by corporations to sort of help the state enlarge its sphere of power. And yes, religious liberty and other social conservatism is a huge threat to that effort. that helps out big businesses, big corporations, and the general sort of bureaucratization of society.
Mark, is big business going to push social conservatives out of the GOP at some point?
You know, that is certainly something that's worth, you know, keeping an eye on. It really was amazing. Indiana, the situation there over their religious freedom law last year was a big wake-up call, because what you really did see was all of these corporations basically acting as the enforcement arm of the Democratic Party in terms of pushing this particular sort of what they saw was part of the gay rights agenda. And it really is tragic, because a lot of the things that they're looking at right now in terms of religious freedom restoration acts and other legislation along those lines, there's no reason why these things necessarily even have to be in conflict. It's just about finding a balance to, you know, carve out an exception where Christians can, you know, act in good conscience to, say, avoid participating in a gay wedding, you know, in the rare circumstances they're asked to do that, which is, you know, a very different thing than saying, you know, a blanket denial of service to gay people, which almost, you know, virtually no one is even doing and isn't really even an issue here. And I don't think that people quite understand what this is about. I mean, they really have been successful at making this, you know, about, you know, putting religious liberty in scare quotes and making everything out to be, you know, anti, you know, gay, when the reality is again, it's about finding a balance between people with competing interests in a pluralistic society. I think I mentioned this in the last show, but I mean, it's really astonishing to me. I mean, there have been very prominent incidents where I think that, you know, they're taking Christians and making them guilty of, you know, actual, like, thought crime. I mentioned the case of Kelvin Cochran on one of the previous issues, et cetera, shows, the fire chief in Atlanta, who had a stellar record and was fired because he had written a book on his free time. He's a Christian man, African-American man, and he had mentioned, you know, homosexuality was a sin, along with a litany of other sexual sins, including, you know, extramarital sex and all kinds of other things. And that alone was enough to, you know, get him to lose his job. I mean, that's a slippery slope that I think that people really need to pay attention to in terms of, you know, what government thinks that they're in a position to do to their citizens, and I'm worried about them.
There's a takeaway line from the Washington Post last week, chiming in on Trump's evangelical support. Let's talk about GOP support a little bit here. And the takeaway line is, Trump does best among evangelicals with one key trait: they don't really go to church. Does that say it all, Molly?
Well, it's been interesting to sort of follow each state as it goes through this voting process, and it's been state after state after state, when exit polling has been done, has shown that while Donald Trump does get a fairly significant portion of the evangelical vote, when you break it down for actual worship attendance, which is, I think, a telling indicator, it doesn't mean everything, but it certainly means a lot, then Donald Trump does much better with the people who are not weekly churchgoers, and he does significantly worse with people who are. And it does help explain. I mean, I think people were very confused after South Carolina when it showed him winning these huge evangelical margins. How could you support a guy who's not really a leader when it comes to religious liberty? All the debates about sexual distinctions or abortion, who has lived a life of personal great immorality in terms of his series of wives, his bragging about sleeping with married women, breaking up marriages, etc. You know, this is not typically what you'd think of as an evangelical candidate. Evangelicals tend to actually care perhaps more than they should about the personal morality of the politician involved. But yes, the actual religiosity does seem to be playing a factor. And I think it's really a challenge for churches to see what's happened here as their own weekly attendance figures have dropped off, even in terms of what people consider to be weekly church attendance. The same percentage of people report weekly church attendance as they have in decades past, but you actually see rates of worship declining. And what we're seeing in that is that people define as weekly what is actually 2 to 3 times a month. And so I think churches should care a lot and notice that as people decline in their worship attendance, it does have ramifications throughout the culture.
Mark, what do you think that's going to mean in the general election for the GOP? Usually the evangelical vote is theirs for the most part. There's a small contingent, kind of mainline evangelicals, that would be voting for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. But what do you think it's going to mean for the GOP, this kind of sussing out of this the real evangelical support for Donald Trump?
That's a really good question. I don't really know exactly what it's going to mean. It depends a lot on how much of an issue social conservative issues end up being, I think, in the general election. You know, it has a lot to do with people's cultural identity as much as it has to do with their religious identity. I mean, there's a lot of quote-unquote evangelicals, as Molly points out, that, you know, aren't necessarily going to church, but very much see themselves as a sort of moralistic people with a biblical sense of, you know, certain morality. And, you know, if life issues and other things become a big factor, then they might still be they might be compelled to get more in touch with that religious identity that they think they have, and that might be motivating, you know, or it could be simply that their relationship with the church, as Molly points out, it has an impact, you know, whether or not they're actually attending church weekly, and they could decide to, you know, either not care enough to show up to the polls. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, it really is one of these situations where we're still trying to figure out how it's going to affect the long term.
I have a theory about this, which is that people who are religious have been doing things, advocating for policies, working, you know, on the pro-life movement, which they've had a lot of success on, but also working on religious liberty movements, which have had mixed success. And they are battered at every single turn, and they do things correctly, and they have, like, some corporations swoop in and tell them that they can't do things, and the government, the governor just, you know, caves and whatnot. I think you're going to see a lot of people just almost retreat from political involvement. It's almost too much to handle. When you're doing things, you're playing fairly, you're going by the rules, you're supporting the right things, and you just get brutally battered at every turn, it is very demoralizing. And the Republican Party has not been good on issues that are of concern to a lot of evangelicals. And you're only loyal to a party so long as it's loyal to you. I don't think the Republican Party has been terribly loyal, even in letting this, you know, Trump phenomenon get carried away. I think you will see huge declines in participation.
Molly, John Fee wrote a column for Religion News Service that I know you enjoyed about the connection or the alleged connection between Ted Cruz and what's called Dominionist Vision for America. What is the vision, and how well does the piece do in making a real connection between that and Cruz?
Yeah, Dominionism is sort of a boogeyman on the left where people who maybe don't understand the conservative religious people so well think that everybody's a dominionist, that it is a huge threat, and it is going to destroy the country. And it's almost quaint in this political environment to have someone sounding the alarm about dominionism, particularly as it relates to Ted Cruz. I actually have myself written against some of Ted Cruz's rhetoric in how he blends religion and politics, but I thought the piece was completely overwrought and almost hilariously so, that there is some threat of a dominionist takeover of the U.S. government. Ross Douthat, who's a columnist for the New York Times, their only conservative columnist, had joked about his liberal followers that if they didn't like the religious right, they're going to love the irreligious right, meaning that you've had all these scare tactics, all these crazy things said about how awful the religious right is, and now you're seeing, you know, with the Trump phenomenon, a rise of a more irreligious right, which should scare these people even more than this boogeyman of dominionism. Not that dominionism isn't a flawed theological approach.
I was just going to add that this is a perpetual boogeyman among journalists. Whenever they are encountered with a big national Republican politician that appears to have a sincere faith of a more traditional strain, it ends up inevitably being tied to some sort of crazy conspiracy. I remember when Sherrin Engel was running for Senate in Nevada in 2010, on the Sunday front page Las Vegas Sun ran this huge article about how she was some secret Christian Reconstructionist, which is another sort of like fringe Christian movement that tries to tie biblical law, you know, to the way we should actually govern America. And the articles, you know, the leaps of logic in the article were just, you know, astounding. Like, you know, she'd been in a room with somebody who was a Christian Reconstructionist or something. And we see this again and again whenever a politician is you know, threatens the sort of established liberal order. And, you know, even reading this RNS piece, I mean, it's really incredible what he says, Ted Cruz is not interested in crafting new models of American pluralism to respond to the country's ever-growing religious diversity. Rather, religious liberty is a code word for defending the right of Christians to continue to hold cultural authority and privilege. And does that sound like somebody who's giving Ted Cruz a fair shake?
His father is a Christian minister who does buy into a dominionist theology. Is there any evidence, Molly, that Ted Cruz himself believes that?
Well, I don't know enough about exactly his views. I don't know enough about it to say. And I do also want to say that it is true that Ted Cruz has used David Barton on his campaign stops. And I think David Barton's historical scholarship, if you can call it that, is deeply problematic. And so there, it's not that there's nothing there to criticize. And but having said that, I think even Dominionism itself, again, a, in my view, flawed theological perspective, can be portrayed as scarier than it is. I mean, there's, I think Ted Cruz's father is of the Seven Mountain Dominionist approach, which believes that Christians should take leadership in all these different areas of life, including culture and politics and whatnot. And you can make it sound scary, or you can just say, well, this is a somewhat mainstream evangelical approach on the importance of people having leadership who also are Christian. And so it's not that there's nothing there, it's just that I did not think that some of the alarms that are sounded are worth being worried about. Ted Cruz has governed for quite some time. We actually see what he thinks about policies and how he would implement them, and he's certainly not loved by the establishment Republican Party, but he everything he's crafted has been well within the typical constitutional approach.
Folks, you can follow Molly Hemingway on Twitter, MZ Hemingway, and Mark Hemingway on Twitter at Heminator, H-E-M-I-N-A-T-O-R. Mark Hemingway is senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks again.
And Molly Hemingway, senior editor for The Federalist. Molly, thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, two issues, the possible punishment for abortionists and their customers, and something that Hillary Clinton had to say about the human rights of unborn persons. Stay tuned.
Common and experienced firsthand by sitting down in classes and actually hearing professors, coming to chapel, which is always the high point of the day, to hear the word of God and to lift our voices in song.
Issues, etc. Regular guest Dr. Paul Grimm on why you should consider visiting Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Spend time talking to professors. I mean, there's not a professor here who will not be willing to take time, whether it's after chapel during the coffee hour or just to come into one's study and sit down and talk for a while, to answer questions, to help them to get a sense of, A, do they want to be a pastor or a deaconess? And then B, is this the right place? And, well, maybe C would be the question, is now the right time for them to make that decision?
If you've contemplated the vocation of pastor or deaconess, contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or send an email to admission at ctsfw.edu.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Since 1989, the Missouri Synod has allowed men without a divine call or ordination to publicly preach, teach, and administer the sacraments. This will be addressed at the Synod's convention this coming summer. On May 17th, Gottesdienst, the Journal of Lutheran Liturgy, will be hosting a conference at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, discussing the biblical doctrine of the Holy Ministry and the Lutheran confession of it. All are welcome. Go to gottesdienst.blogspot.com for more information.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We talk to the biggest names in religion today. Liberal Bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took five loaves and two fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity, Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, issues, etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org.